Yeah, it is. It is.
That's true.
The House Transportation Committee will come to order. Welcome, everybody. I've been deciding I'm going to have to start being a little more efficient with time, and because we're going to have to start putting a lot more stuff on the schedule, but that means I actually have to get here early, too. So we're going to try to work on that. And we're going to go ahead, since we have Representative Nathanson here, we're going to go ahead and open House Bill 3253. And Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This measure, House Bill 3253, establishes a tax credit for plug-in electric drive motor vehicles. This tax credit would apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2010. This measure, as assigned, has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue. And in your packets, you have -2 amendments as well as -3 amendments. They're one page each. Those were submitted by Representative Nathanson's office. And there is a hand-engrossed 3253 with the -2s and -3s, which she is going to speak to.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. And are you on the same bill?
I am, Madam Chair.
All right. Please come up, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. We're going to talk about how to help Oregon's transportation system, economy, and environment by moving toward encouraging electric vehicles. I'm very delighted to bring this concept to you today. A typical combustion engine car built at... Oh, I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13, North Eugene. A typical combustion engine car built in 2009 belches out 90% less tailpipe pollution as one built in the 1960s. That sounds like good news, right? But the net benefits to the atmosphere have not materialized because the average vehicle miles driven per person has tripled. The technology for hybrid electric vehicles is well developed. The market is well established. The technology in this bill is a way to encourage a new and rapidly growing industry in the production of electric drive vehicles. And that production, unlike the current hybrid vehicles we're purchasing today, could be here in Oregon. You'll see some amendments to the bill, and those are to ensure that the tax credits will apply to a wider array of vehicles than what we are encouraging today. Four-wheel, four-door sedans are great family cars. Three-wheel cars for trips to work ought to be available, too. Fuel-efficient driving at highway speeds is great. It would be great to have even more fuel efficiency for all those short and not as high-speed trips in town. So let me tell you a little bit why I think we need to encourage electric vehicles and how this bill could help Oregon. And I want to add a special point to consider as you consider the testimony you'll hear today. There's more to the automobile industry than just the big giants, and I believe you have signed up for testimony some local automakers. Economic benefits are the first I want to tell you about. Built in Oregon, we have companies in Oregon right now working on designing and building electric vehicles and the parts that go into them. Tax credits awarded through this will contribute to economic activity and preserving or creating jobs in Oregon. The recent troubles of the RV and manufacturing industries have left thousands of skilled workers unemployed who could immediately be employed in the electric vehicle industry. The current recession provides a unique opportunity to realign Oregon's struggling manufacturing base toward a new long-term growth industry that will provide high-quality living wage jobs for years to come. The jobs will be in many sectors, including manufacturing, engineering, design, fabricating components, electric charging infrastructure, renewable energy installation, and more. Second, keeping money in Oregon. This bill would, by encouraging the purchase of electric drive vehicles, it redirects fuel expenses to local utilities. The average Oregon driver would spend about $250 a year at local utilities rather than sending $1,100 or more a year to out-of-state petroleum companies. Approximately 85,000 cars are sold in Oregon each year, or $2 billion in sales, all of which are built out of state. Redirecting some of these purchases to local manufacturers would further stimulate Oregon economy. and savings for car owners. Electric vehicles are cheaper to run, the energy as well as other costs. Unlike supporting a combustion engine car, the average Oregon driver would save about $2,000 a year in fuel and maintenance costs by switching to an electric vehicle. And it's savings for taxpayers. Electric vehicles are lighter than gasoline-powered vehicles, which will reduce the amount of wear and tear on crumbling infrastructure. And the result is slowing down the rate of road deterioration. Environmental benefits. Climate change. An electric vehicle charged on the Pacific Northwest electricity grid will produce about 5 times less carbon dioxide than a 30-mile-per-gallon combustion vehicle. And thinking about pollution in cities, as we eliminate emissions of volatile organic compound and carbon monoxide, coupled with a 90% reduction in nitrogen oxide emissions, we'll have cleaner air and healthier people. The public health officer for Lane County, Dr. Sarah Hendrickson, explains, quote, diesel and gasoline emissions are both linked to an increase in respiratory health problems. We know that gasoline gives off a benzene vapor, a carcinogen that is cancer-causing. She goes on to say it makes sense to move to electricity. And finally, batteries are recyclable. 97% of lead-acid batteries are fully recyclable, and other battery chemistry recycling technology is coming online. So Oregonians have already shown interest in hybrid electric vehicles. Let's help provide the next option for them. This bill would help position Oregon as a leader in the emerging electric vehicle market, as a user as well as a producer. So is this idea realistic? Should we be promoting electric cars for Oregon? I think we certainly should. Consider that 72.5% of the workers in Oregon commute alone in cars. Electric vehicles are lighter. Many of the newer designs are smaller. Both the physical footprint and energy cost are less than combustion engine cars. We shouldn't be limited only to cars that are designed to the max, to travel 65 miles an hour on the highway and handle 370 miles on a tank of gas. It's smart to support Oregon manufacturing, and it's smart to show leadership with green technology jobs and green consumer choices. I think it's smart to encourage electric drive vehicles, so I hope you'll support the bill and the amendments to it.
Thank you.
We'll go ahead and Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jules Bailey, and I have the honor of representing House District 42, beautiful Inner East Side, Portland. And it's my pleasure and honor today to join with my colleague from Lane County to talk to you a little bit about this bill. Representative Nathanson covered most of the points that I wanted to cover, so I will keep my testimony brief and speak mainly to some of the reasons why I support this bill. For those of you, and there are many of you that are also on the Revenue Committee, you've heard me talk a little bit about some of the theory behind tax credits, and we've had a lot of discussion of tax credits during this biennium. And in my view, there are two great reasons to look at a tax credit. When we want to induce somebody to do something, or when we want to compensate an expense that has a larger public good component to it. And I see this tax credit as accomplishing both. Amory Lovins from the Rocky Mountain Institute has a great line that he talks about where he says, it's not government's job to pick winners, but with new technologies, government sometimes needs to help with the first 5% and let the market take care of the rest. This is really our time to help with that first 5% in an emerging industry that could really have its epicenter right here in Oregon and create good jobs, high-wage jobs, manufacturing jobs right here in Oregon. Many of you know that the Freightliner plant that has closed and is now being looked at by a Swedish electric vehicle manufacturer as a potential place to locate to manufacture vehicles. The purpose of this bill, I see, is overcoming two potential barriers to the emergence of this industry in Oregon. One is that it's a new technology, and as with any new technologies, there is a cost element there, and that cost will undoubtedly come down over time. And this helps offset some of the cost of electric vehicles and induces people who want to be early movers and pioneers to be able to do that. Second, there's without getting too wonky, a term called a network externality, in which, think of a telephone. The first telephone that created that was created was useless. The second one was much more useful than the first one, because you had somebody to call. And after that, each individual person that got a telephone and got into the network made the entire network better for everybody, because there were more people on the network. So everybody that already had a phone benefited from somebody else getting a phone. Electric vehicles and the infrastructure there operates in much the same way. We have a system that is currently designed around gasoline refueling stations. My guess is that those kinds of refueling stations will continue to exist, but there's also a need to look at networks of plug-in capability, electrical capability in people's homes and businesses and other places around the state. And the more people that purchase and drive electric vehicles, the more sense it makes to have that infrastructure available that helps everybody out. So this bill helps induce people down a path and allows them to be first movers and pioneers, which is what we're really known for in this state. So I would also love at some point to talk with the representative here about a potential sunset. I'm a big fan of sunsets on tax credits, but that can be a discussion for another day.
Thank you. Questions to the good representatives? I guess you've covered everything just perfect, so thank you. I'm going to ask Max Shader and Eric Stoffel and Trevor Steele, if you guys all want to come up.
Thank you.
Welcome, and go ahead. Whoever was first.
Age before beauty. Madam Chair, members of the Transportation Committee, my name is Max Shader Bishin. I'm a co-founder of Barefoot Motors. We design and assemble 100% electric off-road utility vehicles. We moved the base of our business to Ashland in the fall of 2008 and expect to deliver our first vehicles in June of this year. Barefoot thanks you for this opportunity to speak, and we laud the state of Oregon for being so forward-thinking in wanting to become a significant center of electric vehicles. I'm here today as a manufacturer and as an Oregon business in favor of HB 3253, and want to ensure the bill continues to include our type of vehicle, given that our vehicle is not a car. Why? The premise of HB 3253 is to encourage the commercialization of electric drive technology and to encourage that in the state of Oregon. Barefoot Motors vehicles do just that. One, by using components that can be eventually used in on-road vehicles. Two, by serving a large market and hence having a large impact. Three, by encouraging the replacement of a relatively polluting, both emissions and noise, forms of transportation. How do we address number one? Our critical vehicle components, motor, controller, batteries, and chargers, generate over 50 horsepower and can be used to drive on-road vehicles over 100 miles per hour. The batteries we are using in our vehicles, the same chemistry that GM's Volt will use, which won't be delivered until 2011. This is critical. The more these components are used, the more confidence suppliers will have to make investments in manufacturing, and the more invested in producing the components, the quicker their costs will come down. This is the point Representative Bailey was making. Oregon can and should be part of this exciting spiral. With two, serving a large market, I think it will surprise some of you to know that there are over 1 million ATVs sold in the U.S. every year. That's a $6 billion market. Close to half are sold specifically for utility applications, on farms, industrial sites, to land managers. Given the technology available today, there's no reason why 75% of such applications cannot be in the form of an electric vehicle. We did a survey of farms in California. On average, they have 4 to 5 ATVs per farm. In Oregon, as you know, there are 36,553 farms. Thus, it's fair to estimate that there are close to 150,000 ATVs in Oregon agriculture alone. This then leads to point three, replacing relatively polluting transportation and its impact. An ATV is a four-stroke engine, is over 11 times more polluting than a car engine. As a side note, many two-stroke engines still exist out there since the legislation did not change until 2006. They're 34 times more polluting. Adjusting for the mileage driven, these four-stroke engines, replacing one gas ATV is like replacing three to four cars off the road. By passing legislation like HB 3253, you have an easy path to removing the equivalent of a quarter to a half a million cars off the highways. If timing is important, if you share the sense of urgency to move our society away from oil, please note that you do not have to wait 2 to 3 years for the vehicles to get approved by the federal government. Barefoot Motors vehicles will be available this summer, and we as a company welcome any of you to come test drive our pilot production vehicles anytime you'd like. Our electric vehicle, utility vehicles are designed in Oregon, built in Oregon, with Oregon know-how, a local supply chain, and local labor. I hope you can move forward on HB 3253 so that companies like ours can help commercialize the technology that this legislation is encouraging to seed in Oregon. Thank you, and I welcome your questions.
I don't see any burning yet, so we'll go ahead, and then I'm sure there will be some that pop up.
All right. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Eric Stoffel, and I'm the CEO of Arcimoto, an electric vehicle manufacturer in Eugene, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Oregon is at a unique time in our state's history where we have a chance to choose a new direction for growth for our state's economy. We have the opportunity to encourage new, clean transportation solutions that will create quality jobs in Oregon and will provide sustained growth for years to come. One of the best ways to do this is to support and encourage our state's emerging electric vehicle industry. I'm here today to support House Bill 3253, which creates an incentive for electric vehicle production here in Oregon. The electric vehicle is a simple concept with incredible potential. An electric vehicle burns no gas and instead charges from a simple wall outlet. The technology behind these vehicles substantially increases efficiency, which saves the driver thousands of dollars a year and also reduces net carbon emissions. The vast majority of automotive companies are realizing that the electric vehicle is an integral part of the future of transportation. However, it will take many years before these products become widely available to the average consumer. This delay creates a unique opportunity for new, innovative companies to enter into the once-closed automotive market. These companies bring with them the prospect of many local, family-wage jobs that will last for years into the future. The federal government has already recognized these many benefits by establishing a tax credit for electric vehicles. House Bill 3253 matches this existing credit with two additional stipulations. The vehicles must be built here in Oregon, and a wider range of vehicles apply. By choosing to match the federal credit, Oregon would position itself as a leader in this emerging field and would create a compelling reason for companies both local and out of state to site their production facilities here. Electric vehicle manufacturing, as with any automotive endeavor, is a complex and expensive process. This means that before a single credit can be claimed, vast private resources would need to be invested to create the necessary infrastructure to build these vehicles. This directly translates to high-quality, family-wage jobs that would attract employees from a wide variety of backgrounds and skill sets. For example, Arcimoto is already employing workers who recently left the RV industry. In addition, we are actively working with subcontractors and suppliers who formerly served the RV industry, and we have found that the skill sets and capabilities are almost a perfect match for our needs. When we begin to scale up our production, we will be employing a significantly larger number of people from this industry. Customers purchasing high-quality electric vehicles built here in Oregon will keep their money in Oregon. Electric vehicle owners will be purchasing fewer gallons of gas, saving them money, and allowing them to spend more locally. The tax credit in House Bill 3253 is an important step in encouraging consumers to purchase Oregon-made electric vehicles. Thank you for your consideration in this important bill, and I urge the committee to pass House Bill 3253 to the Committee on Revenue with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler, I was going to say these are the two people that are actually manufacturing. The rest are interested party, so if we have questions about that, these are probably the people we want to ask. So.
Thank you. More of a comment, Madam Chair. I've rarely have I seen a tax credit I didn't like to increase and attract investment in the state. But before, I wasn't sure if she was going to leave yet, but I wanted to thank Representative Nathanson and our colleague here for bringing this bill forward. I definitely want to do this. I hope we do. So, good for good work.
Thank you. Representative Widener, and then call.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just going through, and I haven't actually read all the way through the House bill, but it looks like we're just saying they have to be manufactured in Oregon to qualify for this tax credit. So if it's manufactured in California, I think we might have some issues there with trade laws. I don't know if anybody can answer that.
Get an answer for you.
Yeah, because I think we'll have some serious issues with that. Actually, then a quick one. Looking at your three-wheeled Arcimotos here, what's the top speed on that three-wheeled vehicle?
Chair Beyer, Representative Widener. The top speed we're looking at right now is approximately 50 miles an hour, but the current design enables us to go up to 65.
Then I'll battery disposal, have you guys set up implementation program for handling the batteries?
Chair Beyer, Representative Widener, yes, we have. Actually, lead acid batteries have one of the best waste streams for any product ever. Like Representative Nathanson mentioned earlier, it's approximately 97% of the material is recycled by law because lead is a dangerous material. So the batteries we're using is lead acid, which will have that same waste stream, the 97% recycling. Other companies such as Barefoot Motors are utilizing a more lithium ion based approach for battery chemistry. And there are many companies and there's many efforts right now to increase the recyclability and waste stream for those batteries as well. In fact, a company in Bend, Oregon is leading the way, enabling 100% recycling of the material in lithium-ion batteries.
And the cost on that, because I've been doing some research on the internet, because I actually almost introduced a bill making people pay $1,000 up front for battery disposal. I was seeing about $2 a pound for disposing of the batteries. Is that about where we're at?
It depends on the chemistry and the...
Not concerned about the lead. It's the lithium ion, the nickel batteries.
Oh, that is undetermined at this time. So.
Madam Beyer, Representative Widener, with our vehicles, we're actually asking our customers to put down a deposit to give them an incentive so that when they return the ATVs to us, they also return the batteries and we have an opportunity to recycle them. In our technology, our chemistry, you typically can use them to drive vehicles for 20% of their life. There's still another 80%. And we're in discussions with a number of utilities in the West Coast about how you can have a secondary use for batteries as capacitors. There's more and more interest among the utilities to be able to store energy during the day, during peak hours, and have it available, during non-peak hours, to have it available during peak hours. So those are exciting opportunities. And we're about reducing, reusing, and recycling as a business. That's our mission. And we share your concern that we're not just adding more issues to the future generation. So your ideas are welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Call and then Representative Benz.
Yeah, I'm wondering, just trying to get a time frame on this. When do you expect that you're gonna be mass producing car electric vehicles and selling them to the general public?
June.
Chair by Representative Call, we are looking at a production rollout of January 2010.
Thank you.
That's good to hear.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things I've learned about these tax credits is that they have a unpredictable nature about them. And it appears that you gentlemen have started your businesses without the benefit of this tax credit. And that would generally give rise to what I've learned is called a free ride. And that is that you didn't need the tax credit before, and now that we've suggested it's not really that necessary. What that leads one to speculate might happen is that this is merely an additional $2,500 price increase. that we would see tacked onto your product, and thus the money wouldn't really be serving its incentive function. So explain to me why that won't happen.
Madam Buyer, Representative Pence, we've already come out with the pricing of our vehicle. Our vehicle is at a premium. I think we can do the financial engineering and absolutely agree with you. Our business model is not based on legislation and handout. But having said that, I think there's a sense, I believe there's a sense of urgency to encourage a better technology. Electric motor is 92% efficient, and an internal combustion engine is 20% inefficient. The delta is noise and pollution, and it's not an equal playing field. If we were to pay for gasoline what the real carbon impact it has, I think it would be much easier case economically for electric vehicles. And then I go back to Representative what Bailey said, Emery Lovins. It makes a very good point. At the end of the day, okay, no tax credit. We'll fight it out. But sometimes that first getting over the hump makes a big difference, and this would make a big difference for our farmers who are very ROI driven.
Chair Beyer, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Chair Beyer, Representative Benz. One of the things I would like to say about that is there is a massive incentive due to the cost differences for manufacturing to off-site or offshore our manufacturing capability. You will not believe how many opportunities I've had to actually move our vehicle production to China or India or various countries. One of the things I really want to do as an Oregonian is employ Oregonians making the vehicles that we are going to drive. And in establishing this tax credit, which, like Representative Widener pointed out, only applies to vehicles built here in Oregon, will give us that competitive edge necessary to give us the economic reason to keep our production facilities here. Otherwise, I'm afraid, regardless of what our philosophy is, economics might enable us or require us to move our production offshore, which would be an unfortunate event.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I notice that the bill, as it's presented, shows that these merely need to be assembled in the state. So that would suggest that the parts could be assembled in China, imported, and then put together here, which I would assume happens many places. Would that be you guys' approach in any event? And what we really have here is just an assembly plant?
Chair by Representative Benz, more of the strategy we're looking for is we really want to utilize the local manufacturing base as well to hopefully reduce that what you're talking about is not just having a high-level assembly occur here, but much of the actual manufacturing. So we're talking about CNC machining, which is a very automated computer machine process for making, say, frames and various components for the vehicle. That there's a very strong base for that in Eugene and Portland and various locations in Oregon. We're talking about getting some of the thermal form body panels for our car straight out of the companies that used to supply the RV industry based in Cobourg, Oregon. Right now, as written, the bill does have some ambiguity there, and I would encourage you to share your ideas of how to tighten that up a little bit more so more of the value comes from Oregon as opposed to just tightening a few bolts and then calling that assembled in Oregon or manufactured in Oregon.
On a final follow-up. The challenge, of course, for us is to anticipate that foreign competition will result in an imported product that's far less expensive than the one that you are creating, thus driving you to China or elsewhere to drive down your costs. So in an odd sort of a way, our tax credit might actually be working against you. Do you anticipate that happening?
Chair by Representative Benz, in the tax credit working against us, are you referring to, I guess I'm not fully understanding your question. If you could please clarify.
May I follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
The issue is one, if you accept this, if you're going to be have this tax credit available, mm-hmm. There's a number of restrictions on, I suppose, assembly would be one. So, but if we tighten this bill up so that you have to acquire the parts here in Oregon, then that's going to drive up your cost. Thus, when someone imports a car and sells it for less, I guess maybe you just won't be taking the tax credit. You're going to have to say we can't. So maybe I've thought it through now that I've been talking, and it'll work exactly that way. So we would just have to anticipate that maybe an outcome that would take care of itself.
Chair Byer, Representative Benz, I think we just thought that through.
having answered my own question, Chair Byer,
I'm glad you had that opportunity.
Madam Byer, may I respond with some more data points to Representative Benz? Just so you know, we have about 40 suppliers for components of our vehicle. 20 of them, I believe, are in Oregon. 19 of them are in the United States. One of them is in China. To give you, I think it'd be difficult to tighten it too much because we'd like to prove that you can manufacture in the United States, and some of that we need to get components from outside of Oregon. But our chassis is made in Medford. You have a great controller manufacturer, Alltrax in Grants Pass. You have a great wiring harness business here in the Portland area. So there are some really good suppliers in Oregon, and we'd love to be able to use them for our vehicles.
Representative Widener, and then I saw Schaffler call, and Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On my point, the made in Oregon part I don't think is going to hold water. I think we're going to have to go wider because I think there's legal issues there. But one of the things I was looking at is I'm wondering if we really need this tax credit because just the savings someone's going to have in buying fuel and the fact that you have no road tax on an electric vehicle, there is a huge savings that's already there. I actually came close to buying a Tesla. I don't know if you're familiar with Tesla. But it's a $100,000 car, and it penciled out to save money even with that. So I'm wondering if this is really necessary to have it because I don't think your cars are on the same level as that car. And I think we're going to find it's very sellable without having the tax credit because our tax credits have got shut down just to try to inspire people to do additions on their homes or put new windows, energy-efficient windows. And people have made the statement that tax credits help the rich, and that's all they do.
Representative Widener, our vehicle is priced at $11,900. A comparable 800cc gasoline ATV is $8,900. That's a delta of $3,000. I would love to agree with you and say human nature thinks further into the future, and we'll pay the $3,000 so they can save $6,000, and over the 5 years they'll save $3,000. I think we can make that argument to many early adopters, and maybe that's why it's not so bad for us that you say start this credit in 2010. But once we get to the pragmatists, we need a little bit to change the mentality, to change the status quo, to give that jump start, and that's why I think a tax credit could help.
Thank you. Schaffler.
Yeah, once again, I mean, I definitely, we need to incent business in this state. I think this bill does. I freely admit I don't want to, you know, I'm here for Oregon business, not California business, but I think it's clear this is going to help incent and retain and attract investment here in the state of Oregon. Put people to work. I hope you're paying them a good wage down there, a good package, and it'll help the environment. That being said, we're not hearing the Main Street bill in this committee. Phone is ringing. They're driving me crazy. We're not hearing the Main Street bill, but if we do, we should hear bills that talk about the fact that we import timber and gravel into this state, which is about as absurd as you can get. And we have policies that incent that kind of thing right now that need to be taken out of the statute. So, but we're not hearing those bills. We're hearing this bill. And once again, it gives me another environmental vote, so I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question so much as a statement. Like a number of other legislators, I had an opportunity to meet with Youthink Motors this morning. Mm-hmm. The representative from that company, which is based in Norway but has operations in Dearborn, Michigan, is considering moving into the now or soon-to-be-vacated Freightliner plant. They intend to employ up to 900 people assembling electric vehicles. We're one of originally 8 states to be considered as the location of this plant. And they indicated that there were 2 things in which they were interested in making their final determination. One, can they apply the Betsy credits to manufacturing, and 2, will the state offer consumers an incentive to buy these types of vehicles? In doing their research, they've identified an optimal price point of under $20,000. The price of their vehicles at this point, based on production costs, is a little over $30,000. The federal government offers a rebate of about $7,500, and with the addition of this bill, we would then bring the price under $20,000, which, again, they identify as kind of the optimal price to make it a mass market product. So I think that should perhaps play into the committee's consideration as we're thinking about how to bring jobs and, you know, futuristic industries to our state.
Thank you. Committee, we have another bill, and we have a presentation that should be really interesting today, too. So is it burning?
It was just a comment, Madam Chair, to say that Representative Boone has reminded me that there is a difference between Sweden and Norway. I appreciate the correction.
And I have to follow up on it, and I was going to comment that although I'm Swedish, I welcome the Norwegian company, and I'm thinking the Swedes will come in, locate in Detroit, Oregon, and build the long-haul electric vehicle for rural people like me.
And Representative Benson?
I really wanted to ask Representative Edwards if there was an estimate up to car production, how many automobiles are going to be produced. Did they say how many a day, of how many a year?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, I can't recall that information, but I'm sure if you inquired of OECD, they could provide that information. It's my understanding that the company is, they're in production now in Dearborn, Michigan, and would shift their production here in an effort to actually enhance it and increase it.
So. Thank you. All right. Trevor.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I will be brief. I know that the committee's time is limited. The city of Eugene is very excited about this bill. We have recently seen double-digit unemployment numbers in Lane County, and anything that we can do to bring good jobs back to the Eugene area and back to Oregon is a real benefit for our citizens and for our community. The prospect of having this tax credit in there to increase demand for these vehicles and to really increase the need for the infrastructure locally is a huge benefit to the city. So,
thank you. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your input today. I'm going to go ahead and call Alex Kyler.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm the Lane County Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I, too, will be brief because I don't have much to add to the conversation other than I did notice yesterday, and I'm sure many of you noticed, the governor's press release and his ride around on a vehicle that appears to have some promise for Oregon but not necessarily manufactured in Oregon. And we do have a local company, as you've just recently seen, located in Eugene that would produce these, and we're quite excited by the opportunity. The other thing I did find your conversation interesting about the manufacturing, but it sounded like the impression left was that the tax credit goes to the manufacturer. The tax credit goes to the individual who's purchasing the vehicle, according to my read of the bill, and I just wanted to make that clear that it really didn't benefit the company other than to provide an increased incentive for purchasing said vehicle. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. All right, and now John Charles. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute, and I certainly look forward to the day that these vehicles are widely available at competitive prices, and I hope that they emerge through the dynamic market process where investors put up the money and they bear all the risks of being wrong and all the rewards of being right. I think this particular approach has a lot of problems. One is already mentioned briefly, that is, it already has a federal tax credit. Plug-in electric vehicles qualify for a tax credit starting January 1 of 2010. For qualifying light-duty plug-in electric vehicles, it's based on energy storage, and the credit will go for anywhere from $2,500 to $7,500, depending on the battery storage. The first 200,000 vehicles sold by each manufacturer are eligible for the full tax credits. The credit will then phase out over a year. I'm not sure if they get that generous of a deal, why people need to double dip at the state level with state funds. And our program, as I read the current bill, doesn't even have a sunset clause, so that's going to be an open-ended subsidy. I think the effect of this will be regressive. I think the early adopters, practically by definition, are almost always people with higher incomes who can afford this, have the higher tax liability to be paid for by everybody else. They're also going to, at least initially, likely get their vehicles charged for free at PGE and city stations, therefore avoiding the fuel cost. If they don't pay a gasoline tax, they're going to be free riders on the road system. If you took that to its logical conclusion, if everybody did that, we'd have a problem paying for the roads. And the electricity they're using, in addition to the fact they're probably going to get it for free, the people actually producing it at the margin, well, these are all these green power programs that we're subsidizing with hundreds of millions of dollars of BSEE tax credits to the point where some wind farms don't even need to produce any power to be profitable. They're so subsidized. In addition to new forms of currency we've created, like carbon offsets and renewable energy credits, which are completely a function of government regulation. So I think benefits of this accrue mostly to the individual. The costs accrue to everybody. And I think the risk you run, which is why the risk should stay with investors, is you don't know if you're subsidizing the Sony Betamax of this industry or something better. You don't know if you're subsidizing the Jimmy Carter Synfuels Corporation or something else, because you can't know that. Only the market can know that, and that's why investors have to deal with risk-reward. I think I look at this and I see some people get all the reward. Everyone else gets all the risk. I think this industry, generally speaking, broadly defined, is already massively subsidized, and I don't think that is a basis for a sustainable economy. I understand that free is a very good price, but you can't get everything for free. And I think you need to think about where you're going with this in the context of all the other tax credits we have, which tend not to get sunsetted, and what that does over the long term when you have many other competing needs. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your input. With that, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 3253. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3028. And Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This measure, House Bill 3028, allows for the operation of low-speed vehicles on highways with a posted speed limit of 45 miles per hour or less.
And Bannon? I have Eric Sean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eric Sean. I live at 13939 Southeast Fair Oaks Way in Oak Grove, Oregon, between Milwaukee and Gladstone. I drive an electric car. And I'm speaking in favor of House Bill 3028 because it really addresses two issues. The first one is that it creates medium-speed connectivity between urban neighborhoods for electric vehicles whose top speeds are 35 miles an hour. This is needed in order to travel between neighborhoods that are only linked by roads that are posted at 40 and 45. The second issue this addresses is that in my conversations with the city of Milwaukee and Clackamas County, representatives there tell me that regardless of what ORS 811.512 paragraph 2 says, they're telling me that only the legislature can actually create this, adopt this kind of an ordinance, that they cannot adopt an ordinance of this kind. Several other states have already adopted a similar ordinance. There are, I think, five or six. Minnesota was the first. The state of Washington has an ordinance like this that allows electric vehicles that go 35 miles an hour to drive on roads posted at 45. There are three additional goals that this would assist. One is being an electric vehicle. It would help the state reach its goal of reducing the carbon emissions. It would also help the Portland metropolitan area and DEQ to reduce carbon emissions in the metro area. And it would also help Clackamas County to reach its sustainability goals by reducing carbon emissions. So I encourage members of the committee to adopt House Bill 3028, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify and welcome any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you be able to operate this vehicle on a state highway where their speeds are posted at 55, 65 miles per hour?
Madam Chair and Representative Boone, no. This would allow an electric vehicle that can achieve speeds of 35 to drive on a road that's posted at 40 or 45. It's not a freeway vehicle, and it's not a highway vehicle.
You just answered my question, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I need my memory refreshed a little bit, but didn't we have a bill like this earlier with low-speed vehicles? Because I remember ODOT being in here, and there are some safety concerns when they're dropping below the speed limit.
We had medium-speed vehicles before, was the discussion that we had, and there's obviously a difference in standards between a low and a, and that's safety standards and on the vehicles themselves.
So, because that would be my only concern is the safety issue. So, because when you have gas cars, and you probably ran into this following you, you can let us know, but when you're holding traffic up, you have some people that are a little upset trying to get around you at times, I would imagine.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, as a matter of standard driving practice, if I'm driving, for instance, between neighborhoods that are posted at 30 or 35, since I can go 35, usually I'm okay. If there are faster cars behind me, I just pull over. And most of the time, I'm driving for relatively short distances between neighborhoods that are posted at 30 or 35. For example, to drive between River Road in Oak Grove and the city of Milwaukee, there's about a quarter-mile stretch of McLaughlin Boulevard that I would like to drive on. It's a much shorter route. The workaround to that is about 33% longer, and in an electric vehicle, that makes a big difference. It reduces the range.
We have testimony, which you probably don't have the benefit of. It'll be in the back, but from ODOT that talks about the states that have posted speeds for low-speed vehicles, and 40 miles per hour is the highest, and there's only one state that has that. And then it's kind of split between 25 and 35, with 130 thrown in. So it doesn't appear that, in general, the speed limits for the low-speed vehicles have been raised very high, I think, given... So I'm thinking, you know, we could look at this bill and say 35. Oh, maybe we should make that 25. No, I mean, it just seems like that this might be a little bit of a stretch to go to the 45 miles an hour.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we might be talking about two different things. The difference between a low-speed vehicle and a medium speed. The five states that allow electric vehicles with top speeds of 25 or 35 to drive on roads posted 45 are Montana, Minnesota, Oklahoma, Washington, Kentucky, and Tennessee. And that's a different range than the low speed vehicle ordinances.
Thank you.
Okay.
I know that ODOT provided testimony and didn't necessarily want to testify, but I think I'd like to know whether we're talking about a difference between the types of vehicles or the speed. So I'm going to have them come up if you want to go ahead. And I didn't see any other questions for you, so sorry, I was going to let you get away with it. But
good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, Administrator of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I think between Madam Chair and Representative Weiner, you both have hit. House Bill 2120 includes in it a medium speed provision defining a medium speed vehicle with the 35 mile per hour speed allowing 40 mile per hour roads or lower. Mr. Sean, who testified, talked about his vehicle doing 35, is not a low-speed vehicle. Statute in Oregon, low-speed vehicle is a 20 to 25 mile per hour speed vehicle on flat level surface. So there's a mix in the conversation of the vehicle that he's talking about. He has, with current statute of low speed, then you have House Bill 2120, as well as in Representative Cameron had his bill that you heard as well, that dealt with the same issue of the 35 mile per hour medium-speed vehicle, a little higher class of safety provisions to be out in the resident with a 40 mile per hour lower potential limit, which is on your list of bills to consider within the committee. So hopefully that helps differentiate between the two.
I think so. Does the committee have any questions on that? Seeing none, thank you. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3028. And I'm going to go ahead and open an informational hearing. Patrick.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. We have with us some folks from the IBM Corporation, including Naveen Lamba, who's going to speak to us about smart transportation infrastructures and do a PowerPoint presentation. And I believe Mike Dewey is going to be part of their presentation as well.
Thank you. Welcome. And thank you for waiting through our hearings.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mike Dewey on behalf of IBM, and with me is Naveen Lamba, who is the industry ITS leader for IBM, and IBM is one of the world leaders in ITS projects. We have a handout for you. ITS is Intelligent Transportation Systems in terms of that acronym. And Naveen has participated in other bodies, capitals, if you will, and before members of Congress and committees on projects that they have undertaken around the world. And at some point in time, and I personally hope that this body will develop a transportation package. I don't know what it will look like. But I think we need to move in that direction. That's an editorial comment. You can shoot me if you're on the other side later. We do believe, and we've talked to many of you, that there ought to be an ITS solution to that. And quite frankly, the experience from IBM is that one size does not fit all. It's going to be a policy in terms of how you want to deal with technology and the issues that Oregon faces, be it in a rural or urban area. And this isn't just as we talk about technology for urban areas of the state of Oregon or other states for that matter. Again, he's a world expert. I don't want to be a potted plant here, so I'll move back. He has a presentation. You have the information before you. And I think you will find this very intriguing, but at the end of the day, recognize that there are so many projects they've done and they are doing that you can almost develop what you want to do here in Oregon and make it work. The last thing I'd say is for a lot of projects that have started, again, around the world, the public support was not necessarily for those projects, But once they were implemented, the public enjoyed what was occurring out in the real world. And that's something we found. Also, we've been able to deal with, and we'll talk about the issue of privacy, in terms of making sure that that is always a discussion that needs to be had about information technology issues. So, Madam Chair, with that, I'll give Naveen and I'll step back. Thank you very much for your time.
And welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Naveen Lamba, and I'm with IBM. I lead our intelligent transportation practice. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about how we can use technology to address some of the pressing issues that we are facing related to transportation. So again, my presentation will cover, you know, what are these issues, how are some of these things being handled in various other parts of the world. You know, the issue of usage-based pricing is a hot topic all across the country, and Oregon has a leadership position in it. Have some thoughts on that as well. And then, you know, obviously welcome discussion at the end. So in terms of the key issues, you know, there's a big push to invest more in infrastructure. You know, one question is how can we do this different instead of just repeating what we did 20, 30 years ago? You know, how can we make that infrastructure smarter? We can put all sorts of sensors that produce data, but what do you do with that data? How do you use that usefully? The second big one is, you know, congestion. How do you address congestion, improve mobility? What are the tools available to do that? There is always a shortage of money. I mean, everybody wants more money, especially transportation. There is a huge demand for all sorts of projects, but the money available is always, you know, wish that was not a problem, but you know, money is always less. So how can we achieve more with less? I'll give you some examples of that. And, you know, creating jobs, it's more recently, it's become much more of a, it's a more prominent goal. And, you know, we can give some examples of how some of these technologies can help in that direction as well. The environment, you know, transportation is the single largest contributor to poor air quality. So anything that we can do to improve the congestion situation has a direct impact on better air quality. And last but most important, you know, how can all of this improve the traveler experience? I mean, that's at the end of the day, that's a critical objective as well. So, you know, through these some of these examples that I give, I hope to answer some of these issues. Next chart kind of presents I think I jumped up. Well, I don't have it here, but it's in your handout here. It's a circle chart here, which, you know, on the left side, it shows how we traditionally do things. So this little circle diagram here, if you focus only on the left side, the top half of it is what influences demand for transportation. You know, population grows, the cities, you know, grow in size, they spread out, you need to build roads to accommodate all of that. That's the bottom side on the left side here. How do you supply that transportation? So we've got these 20-year plans and 10-year plans, 5-year plans, and so on. So that piece needs to keep going on, you know, where we increase the supply of transportation infrastructure. That's a slow process. It needs a lot of money, but we need to continue to do that. And that's, as I said, it takes time. It takes a lot of money. What can we do in the shorter term? And that's what the right side of this diagram focuses on. How can we use information technology to get better use of the assets that we have? How can we manage demand, perhaps by using pricing or other methods? So, at IBM, you know, to address some of these pressing questions, we are focusing on three broad areas. One we call innovative transportation pricing, and under that we focus all the way from simple individual toll roads or bridges all the way to citywide congestion schemes. Some of you may have heard of, you know, Stockholm, London, Singapore, cities like that have these congestion charging schemes, and the concept of usage-based taxation, that's, you know, you're all pretty familiar with what's happened in Oregon. There's a lot of interest all over the country in this topic, and even globally, there are countries that are starting to move towards national usage-based taxation programs. So all of that, is in that first area of focus of innovative transportation pricing. Second area of focus is integrated fare management. So if you think of any transportation service that requires electronic payments, transit, many cities have electronic fare cards. There is, you know, electronic tolling. There is smart parking, etc. All of those systems can actually be handled by a single back office. There isn't a need to create separate back offices for each one of them. Many cities run parallel redundant systems. There is a lot of cost saving that can be achieved by consolidating that. So that's the idea of being able to achieve more with less, building a better solution with fewer financial and other resources. The third area of focus is transportation information management. There is a lot of data that's created on our transportation networks, the streets, trains, buses, taxis, etc. Today, there's a lot of focus on, you know, the highway folks are focused on how do we run our roads the best we can. The bus people are focused on running their buses most efficiently, so on with the trains and other modes. But very few people are looking at the whole system as one. This is what we have to offer as total transportation capacity. And how can we pull together data in real time across all the modes so that we can run the system much more efficiently? So both from a network operator perspective and a network user, the traveler, from their perspective as well. How can we give them better information about what are their options, what are their costs, what is the real-time state of the network so that they can make better decisions for themselves as well. So those are areas of focus. Very quickly, some places where, you know, some of our projects that we've done, Stockholm has a citywide congestion charging scheme where everybody driving into the city has to pay a toll. It's all electronically collected. There is no manual toll booth of any kind. The idea is to get people to move to public transportation. The city invested a lot of money up front to create the extra capacity in public transportation and then introduce this charge so that people have some other place to go to. There is excess capacity to accommodate these people. So IBM has designed, implemented, and we run the system for the city. In London, they have a similar project, which their congestion charging program has been going on for 5 years now. They wanted the system to be slightly different than what they had, so they competed it again last year, and we won that. So we are at this point redesigning the entire London system, and later this year, the city will switch over from the old system to the new system. In Singapore, again, they have a similar, there's a single fare card that you can use across all types of transportation services, for tolls, for taxis, for transit, for buying things at train stations. Everything is on a single card. So that's the idea of a single shared back office, integrated fare management. So several such examples. San Francisco is looking at a system similar to Stockholm or London. We are helping them through a feasibility study on that. On the usage-based pricing, we've got some pilots. There are some experiments that we are doing, and I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail in a couple minutes. So very quickly, the benefits from Stockholm. Again, these are fairly complex projects to make happen, but from our experience, whenever after the system has been implemented, it has been very successful from every point of view. Just as this example, traffic congestion has virtually gone away. Number of vehicles coming into the city are much less. But more importantly, the number of people coming in are the same. So, there's a key difference there that you don't want to reduce the number of people coming in because then you're reducing economic activity. You don't want that to happen. So the public transportation ridership has increased a lot, so that modal shift from vehicles to public transportation has occurred. Air quality is a lot better, and one big attraction for governments all around the world that many of these programs are actually revenue generating. So, if the people are happy, the environment is a lot better, congestion has gone away, and the city gets money, it's a win-win for everybody. So, it's been fairly successful. Just some highlights of the London program. Again, as I said, we are redesigning that right now. it'll be a lot more flexible and scalable going forward. Interestingly, they've asked us to design a system that will scale up to 30 times today's volumes. And it's not that they expect London to grow 30 times, but any other city in the UK that wants to implement something similar, there is no need for them to create a separate back office anymore. It's that same thing about sharing a back office across multiple applications. So they just need to deploy their field infrastructure and just plug into the London back office, and they're good to go. So here's an interesting tool that we built. Again, this is to deal with traffic information and how what can we do with that to make better use of the system that we already have. It's something called a traffic prediction tool. What this does is it takes real-time traffic from as many streets that have sensors or GPS devices or mobile phones, wherever you can get real-time information from, adds to it historic information, and it's able to very accurately predict out up to an hour from now what will be the state of the network, volumes and speeds. So it can tell you, you know, if you don't do anything right now, in 45 minutes from now, you're going to have these 10 areas that will get congested. And we found that it's very accurate in its prediction. So now it's opened up a lot of very interesting things as to what can you do with that forecasted data. You know, you can, from a network operations perspective, you can adjust either signal timings or ramp meters, or you know, if you have tolls, you can move up that up and down. A number of things that you can do to mitigate any negative thing that's being forecast. That's one piece of it. From a traveler perspective, you know, today you've got these 511 systems, which are really good in what they do, you know, and they pull together a lot of real-time information, but it's not as useful. I mean, if I'm driving along a highway and it says congestion next 5 miles, it's all real-time information that's being processed and fed to these variable message signs, but there's not much choice that I have except sit through those 5 miles and deal with it. But had I known that a half hour ago before I left work or before I left my house, I could have made other decisions based on what it was telling me. That, you know, I'm not so much interested in real time what's happening right now 40 minutes away, but when I'm there after 40 minutes, tell me what the situation will be then so that I can adjust my travel right now. So that's one of the applications as well that we're considering with this. So it's a pretty interesting thing that we're taking forward. The way we are doing some of these projects, especially, you know, if it's something new, we don't want to build this all by ourselves in a lab somewhere just because we think it's good. We'd rather work collaboratively with you know, a DOT, a local government, a university. So we set up this in a few collaboratories around the world. And the concept there is to take some really good ideas, bring together universities, companies, DOTs, etc., to address challenges of a region and build solutions that are deployable. So university research is very good, very critical and important, but the end goal of that typically ends up in research papers, white papers, etc. But we want to take it from there to something that's commercially deployable. So create some pilots, demonstrate how it can be used so that at the end of that effort, you have something that can benefit everybody. So we have a few collaboratories. We've set up one in Singapore already. There are a couple of states in the U.S. that we are very close to discussions where we'll have those created very quickly. And we'd be very interested in trying to set one up in Oregon, you know, with the DOT, with the university, and, you know, any local jurisdictions that would want to be part of it. And then a set of companies that are interested in this concept. And we've got some examples of projects that we've done under this or we expect to undertake under this initiative. You know, just pick one example. Let's say a multimodal route planner. That is, you know, if I'm at point A and I want to go to point B, I want to know what are all my travel options. Today, what typically happens is I go to Yahoo Maps or Google Maps or something, and I say I want to go from A to B. It tells me, you know, here's the road you can take. It'll take you so many minutes. It might introduce traffic into it. It'll tell you what the impact of that is. Or I go to a transit agency website. It will tell me, you know, take this train, take that bus, and you'll get there. You need to walk or what have you. But if we can create something consolidated which gives me the whole spectrum, you can take a taxi, it'll take you so much money, so much time. You could choose to drive, it'll take you so much time. You'll need to park for so much money. I could bike, I could walk, I could take public transportation. So for each one, there is an impact of time, cost, maybe even carbon footprint. And then as a consumer, I can make a choice which one I want to do, which one of those alternatives. So that's those are some of the things we are building in an example of a collaboratory project. All right, moving on to, I think this is a topic of interest to a lot of folks here, usage-based pricing. You know, we all know, you know, what the issues with the fuel tax are. You know, revenues are going down, and, you know, the earlier testimony that we, the discussion we just had where, you know, it's a policy conflict where on one side you want to encourage more fuel-efficient vehicles, you want to encourage electric vehicles, but the more successful you are there, the less money we have to maintain our roads. So, you know, so finding a solution to the gas tax is really critical. So here we've just painted a picture as to what are the different types of charging schemes that we've seen around the world. You know, these blue boxes are programs that exist today, you know, starting from congestion charging schemes like London has or Stockholm has. London today is a flat fee. Stockholm, the fee varies based on time of day, every half hour. There are a couple countries in Europe that have national usage-based pricing schemes for commercial vehicles. So those are the blue boxes, and at the bottom you see the volume of transactions that we are talking about in these systems. You know, the largest ones have a couple million accounts, you know, do 1 million or 2 million transactions each day. But now, if we move to the right of that vertical line, and we talk of usage-based pricing, either statewide or nationwide, we're talking of a huge increase in the volume of data and transactions that need to be handled. You know, 40, 50, you know, because you're talking of every vehicle 24/7 on all roads. So the systems needed to support that are vastly different. And then as we look to the future, you know, we might want to do dynamic multimodal pricing. We could look at carbon footprint or, you know, personal carbon trading based kind of issues. Again, that's a little bit in the future, but there are a few cities that we're having discussions with just to explore the topic. What are the things we need to start thinking about there? So that's kind of the spectrum of, you know, where we are today and what the future might look like. Again, these are a number of questions that I think are on a lot of policymakers' minds. You know, we need to have answers to a lot of these questions of usage-based pricing before something like this becomes feasible in a widespread manner. You know, technical systems to support something like that, a lot more volume. What is the true cost of doing this? You know, the initial cost of the devices, communication, the systems, maintenance costs. We've got some pretty detailed, what we call total cost of ownership models that go into what exactly are the elements of the cost and how does it compare with how we do things today, and, you know, what is the benefit of moving to a new system. Privacy is perhaps the largest issue that we all need to have a very definite answer on. And corresponding to that, you know, you need the privacy, but at the same time, you need the ability to audit the data in some way. You know, and we have explored ways in which you can do those things together. You can do full privacy and full auditability of the data at the same time, and be happy to share details of that as well. Vandalism, you know, now you've got, let's say if it's a GPS-based device, you've got a device sitting in your car that's charging you money, essentially. So you've got all the incentive to spill coffee or drop a baseball bat or what have you. So, yeah, so how do you protect against those kinds of issues? Be confident that the device is doing what it's supposed to do. Revenue and collection and distribution frameworks, very big. I mean, today through the gas tax, we know how it's collected, where it goes, what are the formulas for distribution. Now, suddenly each jurisdiction will know how many vehicle miles are traveled in their boundaries, and they will look for revenues corresponding to that ratio. There'll be some jurisdictions will get less money than today, some will get more, so there'll be issues to deal with there. Standards and interoperability, you know, eventually this will be a national system, so obviously the whole thing needs to be interoperable. But, you know, we need to, in the meanwhile, we'll need to, you know, let's say one state has it and the next one does not. How do you handle border issues and such? Payment methods, there's a huge wide variety of how you can, you know, how you can price this. You can pay at the pump, you can pay, you can have utility-style monthly bills, you can have cellular phone-style monthly plans of minimum of certain usage and then variable. There's many options. So all of those need to be explored and which one works best for a particular situation. Legacy fleet issues, you know, let's say today we have all the answers and we tell the auto manufacturers, build this device in all your vehicles. It'll be 2-3 years before they can incorporate all that. And it'll take 9-10 years before the current fleet flushes out of the system. So, you know, what do you do in the interim? And then, you know, how do you communicate all of this to the public? It's always a challenge, and there are, you know, some ways that work better than others, and we can explore that as well. So just very quickly, these are some of the main attributes that are being suggested as how you can charge: time, distance, and place. So, you know, you vary your tax or charge based on time of day. Peak period miles are more expensive than off-peak miles. You know, distance, obviously, number of miles that you travel. So, and place, where are you? Are you in a congested downtown area? Are you outside of downtown? So those are the three major parameters, and you can have, you can include all three, of course, you know, time, distance, and place, or you can have combinations of them. So those are the major ones, but there are several secondary attributes that you can include: type of vehicle, emissions, type of highway. You know, on the right, you said event-based pricing you could have, occupancy-based, you know, hot lanes, essentially are occupancy-based pricing. And you can have some really interesting custom rules. Like, for example, from a particular origin to a particular destination, there is very good public transportation alternatives available. But if you choose still to drive that origin-destination pair, you might want to charge higher for that. Just, you know, there are exotic things that can be created that way. Environment, interesting. I live in Virginia, and we've got these code orange and code red days typically in the summer based on the ozone level forecasted for that day. And on code red days, public transportation is free to encourage people to use public transportation. One way to further encourage that is actually increase the toll or usage fee on that day to further, and that extra money can fund public transportation that's free that day. So again, you know, you can create very specific business rules as well. So all this is, you know, theoretical slide where what we've done is we've actually now created a functional prototype that is creating some answers to all this. So we have a few hundred vehicles running around producing this data that we are collecting, and we are helping create answers to some of these questions. And what we want to do with that data is, you know, basically cleanse it so that, you know, privacy issues are not a concern, and provide it to policymakers like yourselves, where you can play with that data. You can say, okay, you can first of all create custom policies. We want to charge based on distance, time, type of vehicle, whatever. And if you apply those business rules to this set of journeys, what is the revenue, you know, what revenue can we expect to get? What is the timing of that revenue? Then you can change the policy, basically evaluate one policy against the other and see what will be the impact on that same set of journeys. So just a tool to play around with, you know, what are the different choices available. Again, it's a open platform. You know, what our interest in doing this is to create a framework where multiple players that need to be part of the solution, they can all be part of this in an open, in a non-proprietary system. So, for example, the onboard units, we don't make those onboard units. What we've done is we've just created the standard as to what information these units need to provide. And today there are three manufacturers that are already producing devices to that standard. There are three others that are in the process of doing that. So anybody who wants to create a device is welcome to do so as long as it meets that standard. And that concept flows across the whole framework. again, you know, it has the back office. This prototype has the back office computing horsepower to handle all these vehicles. You can visualize. You can do all sorts of things with this tool. Just a few snapshots of the tool. You know, you can log in either as a user or as an administrator. This just gives an example of a particular user. You know, this particular person has a small vehicle. Emissions class is low. You can search your journeys by month, by date, etc. It's showing one particular journey. You can click on that journey, and it shows you more detail about, you know, what were the different charging components to it. You know, 2 miles were in downtown, 3 miles were during peak hours, etc. I mean, you can look at the breakout. You can look at the same information on a map. You can here this one particular, you know, person leaves home. Again, here, while we are in this trial where we want to test out all the aspects of this, we are not constraining it in any way. So, you know, something like this, you don't want to have available from a privacy perspective. Here, you know, this journey is starting from that person's house, you know, where he is going. The height of the bar is the speed. The green color at the top of the bar shows the confidence of the GPS location. So we match against 10 satellites, and if you're very confident of that location, it gets a green color or a yellow or a red. But from a privacy perspective, you would handle it. You would not make this information widely available to everybody. But at this point, while we are experimenting, we don't want to apply any constraints. Test out everything, and then slowly, if we want to demonstrate how we address privacy, then we will constrain this significantly. Here's another example where, you know, the vehicle is going along and then it goes under a bridge. So you obviously lose the GPS signal under that bridge, but you can intelligently guess that, you know, the vehicle just went past that. You know, on the other picture, it shows some which are red. There's an issue there that needs to be addressed. Why it is red? You know, so it just helps you flesh out what the issues with the system are, why it's not doing certain things the right way, to get the right system up and running. And then, you know, it has a lot of functionality. I've just picked a few screenshots here, you know, how you can handle disputes. Once you handle a dispute, it then gives the transportation authority access to some of the detailed data so that they can resolve the issue with you and so on. So much of this, you know, we just wanted to make a point that, you know, we've discussed this a lot over, you know, several states, you know, there at least a dozen states that are exploring this very actively. So we just wanted to move from slideware to something that's real. And, you know, if you want, I'd be happy to do a real demonstration logging into the actual system at some point. So just to recap, I mean, there are a number of technology-based solutions just based on, there's a lot of data that we have which we don't use. We can make a lot of use of that to run our existing systems a lot better, and those solutions exist today. So it's you know, and they're being used in many places. So, you know, we could perhaps pick a concept like a collaboratory to explore these, figure out the use, the benefit, the applicability of some of these, and then once we can justify the benefit, we can deploy it on a wider scale. The usage-based pricing, obviously, it's something that is front and center of you know, a lot of our minds. And Oregon right now, you know, it has a leadership position in this. You know, Jim Witte and his organization, they've done an excellent job. Everybody in the country and the federal government is looking at Oregon for answers. So, you know, and today Oregon is way up front in the thinking on this. So, you know, I think we have to move forward with this concept going forward. So the sooner we can do it, the better. I mean, it's, you know, if we wait 4 or 5 years, the situation will be much worse. You know, we have some of the answers today. We just need to prove that they work, and we can move forward with it. So just some of the thoughts I had. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Boone.
Thank you. I have actually three. And I'm assuming that I was just in London, and the system they had there was a sticker on the dash or the window. And so are they going to be going to a GPS-driven system or electronic system?
So London today, Madam Chair and Representative Boone, today London is it's a camera-based system, and it's not a tolling system. It's a more an enforcement system. Mm-hmm. And let me define what that means. So when you drive into the city, you are expected to have prepaid for coming into the city, and it's pretty steep. It's £8 a day. With today's exchange rate, it's not as bad as when it was $2 to a pound a while back. But if you've not, if they take a picture of your license plate and see that you've not paid by midnight that day, then, or you can pay by midnight the following day, you have to pay an extra £2. But if you've not paid by then you get a £100 fine. So it's more, the cameras are there more for enforcement. So when you come in, you should have paid. The new system will be different, where it will, in addition to cameras, you will also be allowed to have RFID tags. So it will be a dual system. You can have an RFID tag, or if you choose not to, then we work with the license plate. So Stockholm was a dual system initially. They had cameras, and if you they had RFID tags, and if you don't have that, then cameras. For a number of reasons, the camera-based system in Stockholm worked very well, and they moved to a exclusive camera-only system now. So the permanent system is camera-only. London was a camera-only system. They said, hey, the Stockholm system works really well. We want a dual system. So, so again, there's no one-size-fits-all. You know, for different situations, there's different answers to that. So,
and follow up, you answered my second question. And then the third question is that the GPS-type system, and I don't know if you know about the pilot project that Oregon did for the vehicles.
Yes, very much
mile
so.
Travel. Yeah. Okay. So is that what that particular kind of GPS-type system is? Is there something up there it doesn't transmit to you, or you transmit to it where you go, something like that?
Yeah.
I can't remember which way it goes.
Yeah. The current system, the experiment that was done right now, it was a device that it did not measure coordinates at all. It kept track of miles, number of miles traveled. So, you know, you could do miles traveled in a particular zone or in a total day or between fills, etc. So your specific coordinates, where exactly you've been, is not recorded.
Okay.
So it was very good from a privacy perspective. So there's that benefit, but there are other things that you are not able to do because you're collecting a very limited amount of data. Whereas in a GPS-based system, as I presented it, you're collecting full details of where the vehicle is going. So it allows for a lot more policy options in terms of how you want to charge. You can do many different things. And there are ways in which you can protect the privacy of the person completely, where you can have the full flexibility in terms of the charging policies, but still not reveal the data of where exactly the person is going. So it gives you some benefit there.
Thank you.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I apologize for my eyes being closed so much. You turned the lights down in here. I can barely stay awake with them on, let alone. But that being said, this is a fascinating stuff, and I want us to do it someday. We're going to have to figure out some way to get money out of people to pay for roads other than the gas tax. So I'm driving down the road. I get pulled over for being such a good citizen. And the police officer, does a police officer have a scanner that would scan my barcode to make sure it's a valid code? Or, because you could just take whatever it is, you talked about the vandalism, whatever it is reading my car, I could steal someone else's and put it on there and drive around for free. How do you do that? How do you, the enforcement side, how do you know my barcode or whatever is attached to my car is mine and I'm paying my share?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative, it's, there are many ways to do it. I mean, it's, you know, you could potentially embed the device deep into the vehicle where it's not just something that you know, a driver can easily unplug or plug into the vehicle. It can be, there are many ways to do it where you can, and that's an area of research that we're doing, which we call anomaly detection, which multiple aspects of it. First of all, validating that you have a device and it is your device or it is the device that is associated with that vehicle. How do you monitor that there is no disconnect there? And secondly, because people will always come up with creative ways of beating the system.
Yeah.
What are the ways in which, and many of our projects, more effort is spent on finding fixes to how people might want to beat the system. You know, building the basic capabilities is relatively simple. It's those anomalies that need to be. So we can come up with a whole wide variety of ways in which, you know, eventually when it's built into vehicles, it will be there in the vehicle. It'll be difficult to disengage, but you know, there'll always be people who will come up with ways to do it, and then it's always a fight between that small set of folks and law enforcement to stay on top of each other.
That's why we have prisons.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Madam Chair, maybe we could implant the device in Representative Schaffler's forehead, then we can track him walking around, too. So, I'm wondering here if somehow we couldn't be overcomplicating this, because with the electric cars and stuff coming out, what if we just did a flat monthly fee on them? Because I know every time I fill my pickup with fuel and it's on empty, I'm paying upwards of about $16 in tax right now to fill my truck with diesel. And if we just went $50 a month for every electric car sold, wouldn't that take care of our problem? And it'd be a lot easier than trying to implement a system like this and get it into all the cars out there?
Madam Chair and Republican Representative Widener.
Republican was correct, too.
There are several flavors of doing this. Each one has, there is some of the, in fact, the gas tax system, there is a lot of beauty in the simplicity of it, of how you can collect the revenue, and the cost of collection is very low as well. So for each one of these, there are benefits and disadvantages as well. So it's depending on what the objective is, if that solves it, then that's fine. But if you want to implement policies that allow for flexibility of different types of, you know, I want to charge based on type of highway or type of time of day or whatever, so it will allow you to do certain things, but there'll be certain things which will not be in your set of policies that you can move forward with. So we just need to evaluate what the end goal is, and if that satisfies it, then that's fine.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for your presentation. It was very, very interesting. You mentioned you're running pilots in other states. What types of work are you doing that may lead to some short-term solutions?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Edwards, it's the pilots that we're doing right now are more in, it's in several countries in Europe. We are having active discussions in a few states that are interested in doing pilots. So in the U.S., I think that at this point there are probably four or odd states that want to do pilots in the near future. Mm-hmm. And there are at least 6 to 8 more that are going through various legislative discussions as to, what bills to introduce and so on. So what we are thinking is, this prototype, for example, we have some functionality that is already implemented. We have the back office infrastructure that's running all this, has the capacity to handle a number of vehicles, a few thousand vehicles at least, and we can easily scale that up. And we are continuing to grow the capability of this prototype. So through these pilots, what we are hoping is that we can bring this to the table, not have to spend scarce financial resources to recreate this. Instead, spend the money to add to this, to answer, so if there's 5 out of 20 questions that we already have answers for, mm-hmm. let's find answers to the next 5. And perhaps do it sorry, today that word is not coming out, but do it jointly with some of the other states that are interested in this as well. So, you know, let's say Oregon takes on 5 of those questions in their pilot. Let Minnesota take on the other 5 so that jointly, you know, we have answers to a broader set of questions so that collectively we, you know, we move the state of the art forward. So.
Follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So in that vein, are Washington State or California looking at some pilots that we might be able to leverage if we were interested in doing something?
So Washington has done an experiment already. I think they've concluded that. But from what I'm aware, Minnesota, Texas, obviously Oregon, Nevada, these are some of the states that want to move forward with pilots soon. And there are others, Pennsylvania. California is interested. They're slightly behind at this point in terms of, you know, how close they are to a pilot. Mm-hmm. But there is a lot of interest in this at the national level as well. So we're doing a lot of discussions with the transportation committees there, mm-hmm. thinking through some of these issues. And it's going to happen one way or the other. So.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? I think given our pilot program with the vehicle mile, which I said I'm not going to say those words anymore, but we were going to find a new name for them, and the privacy issues, which that we know, I mean, those of us that have been around the program, seen it at work, know that the privacy really isn't a problem in our policy. How do you overcome that discussion? Because surely you say that you've had a lot of times when you go into these cities that there is some pushback from the users of the system that they get over. But is there, you know, have you been, how yeah. have you been able to get over that?
Well, Madam Chair, that's, let me give you a couple examples of, so let's, you know, let's say we have a full-fledged GPS-based device that's producing coordinates, measuring coordinates. So you've got to deal with that extreme situation. So one way is to, you know, whatever the charging policies are, let's say I say I'm going to charge based on number of peak period miles, number of off-peak miles, number of downtown miles, and non-downtown miles. Let's say those are my 4 categories. So instead of the device just, you know, capturing coordinates and transmitting to a back office which figures out what needs to be done to that data, make the device a little smarter. Let the device, from those coordinates, translate that into miles of each type of charging category, and it will start adding miles and storing it on the device in these 4 buckets that we've defined. So, and at the end of the day, what it transmits out, or end of the week, however often we want to do it, it transmits out aggregate number of miles in each category. So where you've specifically been never leaves the device, only the total miles. Or you can go a step further and put the rates of each category on the device also. So what transmits out is, today your tax bill is $3.20. Where you've been, how many miles, don't know. When I get my bill at the end of the month and I'm happy with it, I pay it, and you can create a policy that after the payment is received, delete all the data within 30 days. So it's all gone. If I have questions on it, I have the ability to go into the device and visually see those journeys that you were seeing. Which day did I do what journey? And I satisfy myself before I pay the bill. If I still have a problem with it, then I can initiate a dispute. And that then gives the various agencies access to that data so that they can sort out whatever the confusion is. That's one approach to the privacy issue. A second one is where, you know, if you actually do need to transmit all the data, then you need to treat that data very carefully, handle privacy and all that. And there's a lot of experience. I mean, we do a lot of almost all the, in the banking industry, all the customer accounts, all of that, we run a lot of those systems. And you just need to, you know, so handle that in a very, very controlled, who has access to what data, what can they do with it. You've got to have very detailed, rigorous controls over that. So there are multiple ways of approaching it. And it's, you just have to start somewhere. I mean, you know, a lot of these questions, for the people, you know, let's, if we start a pilot, you know, there'll be 200, 300, 400, 500 people that will be very interested in joining a pilot. And then we can, you know, get experiences from them. What do they think of privacy? Were they able to, were they satisfied with the experience and so on? But till we don't get started, there a lot of these questions we can just theorize as to what the answers might be. But, you know, we can, it's important to get started somewhere so that we can, you know, we can get to the end game. So.
Thank you. Questions? Are we all done? Well, I think that's all the questions for you. Thank you. I just, just as a response maybe to Representative Widener, I think that ideally simplification is great if you can do it. I think that a person who might be driving to the grocery store and back 3 or 4 times a week, and the person like me who's driving back and forth from Salem, you know, over 500, 600 miles a week, might have a little bit of an issue with the fact that I'm paying the same price that they're paying. And they're not using the system to the point that I am. So I think that, you know, oversimplification doesn't work very well sometimes.
Your overall savings, though, because you're not having to purchase fuel, would be still much greater. So with it, with the electric car.
Right.
Yeah, can I comment on that, Madam Chair? So yeah, I mean, it's, so from a user perspective, it'll be a benefit because you save that money, but from a agency perspective, or from a DOT perspective, they're getting less revenue in for the wear and tear you cause on the roads and the congestion you cause, et cetera. So, as I said, it may be the right answer for a particular situation, you know, but we need to explore what are all the objectives we need to meet. And if it satisfies it, excellent. I mean, at the end of the day, the simplest solution that meets the objectives would be ideal, because you don't want to overcomplicate it for no reason. You just make the capabilities of the system as less complex to achieve the goals you want. So,
not to get me wrong, I like the idea because this would allow local control. So now when people from Portland keep driving through my district to go to the coast,
yeah,
I could tax them more.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there are,
yeah,
benefits for this. It's like $5 from everybody from the metro area that drives through Dundee.
I think so.
Yeah, I mean,
there's your answer.
Connecticut was, that was exactly the point. They said, we have a high gas tax. These trucks fill before Connecticut or after Connecticut. And they just rip through our roads, you know, these heavy trucks and all that. So, you know, they got to maintain those roads, but they're not getting any revenue from those people. So here they can tax them. So.
Thank you very much for coming. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Welcome to Oregon.
Thanks. It's a lovely state. I mean, I keep, you know, it's a great example of well-planned state, and Portland is a global example of a good, nicely planned city. So.
Right, that might be the the place to go for any work on this. But with that, thank you.
Thanks again.
And we are adjourned.